Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and my guest today is Jean Doe Massoero, who is an Alexander Technique teacher in Montpellier, France. That's in the southern part of the country. And this is the second interview we're doing on the subject, the Delsarte and the Delsarte method and Alexander and the Alexander technique. In our first interview, we covered the historical connections between Alexander and Delsarte. And in this talk, Jean Doe is going to talk mainly about the implications of that for what the Alexander is seen like today, how it's changed over time. Jean Doe, welcome to the show.
And hi.
Could we begin I'll just begin by saying that you have uncovered some really quite astonishing connections between Alexander and Delsarte. And we were just starting in the previous interview to talk about some of the implications of that for what we think of as the Alexander technique today. Maybe you could just very briefly summarize what you said towards the end of the last interview about a distinction that you draw between the early work of Alexander and his teaching, say between 1896 and around 1915, I believe, and what happened afterwards. Yeah. And then anything else that you'd like to talk about what Alexander included, what he didn't include, what he added to Delsarte, that sort of thing.
Yeah. There is a change in the way Alexander promotes his technique. When he starts in 1896, everybody will see in article and lecture on the paper, his work paper, that he's a teacher of the Delsarte system. And in the middle of the paper, there is a motto, there is a phrase. And this phrase is, a part of a poem that is known in the Shakespeare world. And it's called, in the middle of the paper, what is written is, "Thy mind a kingdom is," that your mind is a kingdom. And this is really a Delsarte idea. A Delsarte took that idea and developed that idea, meaning that for Delsarte, the body is just an instrument of the mind. And if there is a vicious action, for example, that you can notice when somebody is standing or sitting or moving, for Delsarte, this is an expression of a mental phenomena. It is not something in the body. Yeah? Mm-hmm. It's something that is, there is a preconceived idea. There is a trouble in the direction of the will. Because in fact, I must say something first of all, is that Delsarte's own writing are not easy to read for a simple reason. Is that, first of all, they've been written before a long time ago. And second, Delsarte was a mystic. He cannot write without involving religion one way or another. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's very interesting, but sometimes it's really painful. You know, we would like to get to the meat of the practice, and nobody can nowadays because nobody understands Delsarte. I think that nobody understands Delsarte as Alexander understood him when he started. So, for example, Delsarte doesn't talk about the mind directly. It talks about the soul. And for Delsarte, his description of soul is for us would be, in fact, like the relationship between mind and will. Mm-hmm. And for Delsarte, their will is an intricate system where you can decide, you can will, you have got a verbal will. I decide to say some words and not others. I choose to speak in English and not in French, for example. That's my will in action. But I've also, for Delsarte, what we call a practical will. I decide to tense or not. But when I move, for example, from standing to sitting, one of Delsarte's very famous postural practice, in fact, there are some rigidity, for example, of laxness that happens without my will being really active. It's like beyond myself. Well, Delsarte has a very simple way to look at this. He says, well, your will needs training. Your conception of the movement has to be changed and your will has to be trained. So in the Delsarte idea, what he was always talking about, the reciprocal action of mind and body. Yeah, it's something that talks to us, Alexander teaches. But for him, there is nothing wrong in the body itself. There is nothing to be changed in the body. The body is the expression of your use of the mind and your use of the will. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about the use of the self, the first Alexander technique, what I call the initial Alexander technique, it was the use of the mind. It was not the use of the body itself. It was not the use of the muscles. Delsarte is a very as great knowledge of biomechanics, a knowledge of psychology that is quite outstanding. And he was quite, he understood the fact that it's impossible to direct the muscles. The muscular system is so complex that it's absolutely impossible to direct into the muscles. For Delsarte, this was to be left for the practical will to adjust itself. It should be directed consciously, but the actual programming of the muscle is absolutely subconscious and will ever be. And that is quite close to modern biomechanics, modern thinking of the way our brain interacts with the periphery. So the first trend in Alexander technique, his first Alexander, his initial technique up to 1915 was exactly like that. It was training the mind of the person, training the will of the person. That has changed because afterwards we see in his writing that there are sentences that are complete, that are perfect, and then suddenly he put a comma at the end and he adds something about sensory appreciation being necessary. The right feeling should guide the movement. Mm-hmm. This is clearly 20th century thinking. This has nothing to do with the original thinking of the Alexander technique, and it's very, very, it's remote. It's absolutely different from the Delsarte writing. You understand? So,
right. And just to break in here for a second, that shift that you're talking about kind of goes along with a greater emphasis on Alexander using his hands to guide people.
Yes, absolutely.
And I believe I believe it's in Frank Pierce Jones that he one day announces to his students that I can get it for them myself now.
Well, it's in Goddard Binkley's.
Is it in Goddard? Yeah.
Yeah. But absolutely, that's quite clear.
Yeah.
And that's 1931. It's a long time after his discovery.
Uh-huh.
Very, very long time after that.
Right.
So now, let's talk about the connection. What is fantastic, really, in between the two men. So we've got on one side the rigid convention, you should do as you're told, and the other side, there is free expression, do what you like. Both doings, for both men, in fact, suppose that you do according to what you feel. And they both discover that what you feel leads you to wrongdoing all the time. What you feel is a very poor cognitive representation of movement. And Del Sartre thought that movement or guidance should be, in fact, directed by reasoning, by experimentation, by science.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very strong position he got there. And what he was after, in fact, he looked for something in French we call grace, but in English I think it's better translated as poise.
Mm-hmm.
He was after, in fact, improved functioning. I will tell a little story. When he started his studies, he was a very poor young man, but he had the chance to have a fantastic voice. He was a like we would call a natural singer. And because of that, he was accepted in the highest college of singing in France, the Royal College in Paris. And after 2 years of training, he lost his voice. He couldn't sing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that started the whole process of observation and discovery. He discovered, in fact, that his teacher, every one of them, had their own idea about the good use of the different parts of the system. And each of them had no idea of the functioning of the whole system. So he started to, first of all, to join the Academy of Medicine. He started to study medicine, and he started to cut bodies to understand how the larynx and the vocal cords were organized, and why was it possible suddenly that his voice could be damaged by what it did, what he was doing with himself, how he trained himself. And he discovered what he called a barometer. Barometer is a tool to, in fact, assess the weather.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Right.
Okay, it's the same word in English?
Yep.
Yeah. And he called it a barometer of human use.
Or
and
sort
it
was of a gauge.
A gauge, yeah.
Yes.
Of the human use as a whole. And it was called, and it was the larynx box. Because, in fact, the larynx box is not articulated to the bony structure. So if there is any tension in any part of the body, the larynx is going to be pulled out of place. That's the Del Sartre discovery.
Mm-hmm.
So he discovered that, in fact, singing or speaking are not specific activities. They are integral activity, that's his word. They are of the body as a whole. And if you want to change that, for example, imagine that he wanted to regain his voice. There was no way a specific action on the neck would change his problem. He understood it was a problem of gesture. So there is a definition of gesture. A gesture is a movement that you make. Well, it's not exactly the same with Del Sartre. For him, a gesture is a whole body attitude, a whole body organization, a whole body movement.
And that insight, yeah, that you just described, that could have been articulated today by a great many Alexander teachers, right?
Of course.
They would say the same thing. They might use slightly different phrases. They might not emphasize the larynx quite as much. They might talk more in terms of the neck, but it's,
yeah,
the same idea, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the same idea, and Alexander used exactly the same idea in order to solve his own voice problem. You understand?
Well, it's, and he even talked about that he was depressing his larynx. He noticed. Yeah, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So that's one of the greatest discovery, but it's the discovery in itself is not because once you know that instead of trying to fix one problem after another, you have to change the self as a whole.
Right.
Well, you are against a very, very deep way of solving problem that we all have. We all are, well, the English Alexander teacher would say we are engainers, but Del Sartre's presentation is much clearer. He said that we tend to, in fact, cut big problems into small problems in order to make them good before we attack the big scenery. And he just discovered that this was the worst bad habit of mind that you can have if you want to solve a movement problem in your body.
Right. And maybe just to make that even a little clearer, solving little problems as a way of solving a big problem might work for a piece of machinery like an automobile.
Yeah.
Spark plug needs replacing. You just pull out the old one, put a new one in,
yes,
and the car is good to go.
Yeah.
But it is woefully inadequate to deal with a complex organism like a human being.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Del Sartre would say you have to, in fact, go for the cause. And the cause is lame and humpback minds. That's his expression.
What was that phrase again?
Lame and humpbacked minds. Lame is you can't walk properly. Humpbacked means that you have a bad back. Humpbacked. You don't use that word. Humpbacked. Humpbacked. How do you pronounce that?
Humpbacked? Humpbacked?
Yes, humpbacked minds.
Oh, a humpbacked mind. Okay.
Lame and humpbacked minds.
So if you
body.
Have, so what he was saying is if you have what appears to you to be a physical problem,
yeah,
like losing your voice, that you've got to deal with a flaw in your thinking.
Exactly.
Okay, got it.
Okay, and a flaw in your will, in your direction of the thinking and your direction of the will.
Exactly. Okay.
So what's grand in Del Sartre, in the Del Sartre system, is that he didn't stop there. He, in fact, started a formidable work of what we call notation. Because Del Sartre nowadays is well known around the world for example, his influence in the modern dance. And all the people that are researching Del Sartre are very interested in these ideas. But also, he's well known because we see more and more some what we call virtual agent, which are, in fact, when you look at a film where there are virtual humans. There was this film recently with green people, very tall green people. I can't remember the name of it, but they were lifelike. They were obviously computer created, but they were lifelike. Well, it's quite interesting to know that there are many research labs in the state that are, in fact, using what we call an action coding system. And an action coding system helps you to notate the movement through a system of signs and system of diagrams. Mm-hmm. And all this has come because it's been totally influenced by the work of François Del Sartre. He invented a way to code movements.
Okay.
And that's our trouble today. mostly originated in the fact that Alexander forgot half of it. He was fantastic because he, in fact, integrated the thinking of Delsarte into the modern world, but he forgot a very, very important thing because he was not a draftsman. He couldn't make a picture. And Delsarte had a way of drawing the different parts of the body mm-hmm. and the different relationships. And he would show you a different, for example, Delsarte was, I think, the first to imagine that the greatest movement that we have to master is the movement of the torso. Of course, Alexander, he will write about that. He will explain it with his own words that I've got a sentence by Alexander that fits very well here. He say the direct control of a finger of the neck or of the limb of the legs should primarily be the result of the conscious guidance and control of the mechanism of the torso, particularly the antagonistic muscular actions that are responsible for greater and correct coordinations intended to control the movement of the limbs, of the neck, of the respiratory mechanism, and the general functioning of the internal organs.
So it almost sounds like he's saying the torso is primary control.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Right. Well, I found that straight away, that that's in Man's Supreme Inheritance. And it's very clear. I asked Walter Carrington, and I asked him, why is it that before 1930, it's all about the mechanism of the torso, and then antagonistic action of the mechanism of the torso, and then it disappears, and then you've got primary control that arrives in 1932 in the use of the self. Well, I remember the face of Walter Carrington look at me with a smile, and he said, there, you have it. It's the same thing. Yes. But there is one thing is to speak about the antagonistic action of the mechanism of the torso, but it's something else to describe it, to make it appear in front of your eyes, to make you understand that there are parts in the mechanism of the torso, and these parts have to be directed properly. But we know, for example, that in the direction of the primary control, there should be back to lengthen and widen. Well, and Alexander, in his second life, the second life of his technique, says that these words are awfully inadequate unless somebody is able to, with his hands, manipulate the person to explain what it means. Yeah.
So you need, in that view, you need a third part, a second person to come and help you.
Yeah.
Which I believe you said Delsarte didn't really have that model, right?
No.
You were going to work on it on your own, maybe with the help of his drawings and his writings.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And so Alexander makes a very, very big mistake here. And I think he knows he's doing it. I think it's a ploy. It's to get customers. It's to get clients. He knows what he's talking about. I'm sure he's adding this just in order to satisfy the big part of his customer base that are thinking in that manner.
A question occurs to me in this. When you say Delsarte was good at drawing and pointing out sort of, in a way, details, right?
Yeah.
Of movement or specific observations of specific movements. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely.
That sounds a little bit like dividing the body in pieces. And it seems to me that once you do that, and you have a bunch of movements that you're trying to coordinate, that's not going to work because it's just too complicated.
Well, I will answer that. Okay. I think to answer it, there are two ways. I could get the Alexander way or the Delsarte way. Let's start with the Delsarte way.
Okay.
Delsarte was very clear about the need of adjustments of the parts of
right.
the body. Yeah. And I think that also appears in Alexander books. And he was very, very aware of the complexity of the muscular system. But he didn't think in that way. He didn't think that you needed to change the way your muscles acted on your system directly.
Mm-hmm.
He was the father of the indirect way. Mm-hmm. So let me explain how this is much more simple mm-hmm. than what you may think. Mm-hmm. For Mr. Delsarte, we have a tendency to believe in what we feel and to disregard what we cannot feel. But science has made it clear that it's not what you feel, that the appearance of things that counts.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So for Delsarte, there are two principles. One is called the static and the other one the dynamic. And both of them are principles of mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
So, Delsarte considers that inside your body there are bones. He doesn't call them bones, he called them levers.
Right.
So, normally a lever is for a purpose. You understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And he considers that it's possible for you to understand the different levers of the torso. It's not that you are going to, in fact, think of all the bones of the torso. No, you are going to group bones that are acting together to produce different movements.
From an Alexander perspective, that sounds a little bit like body mapping.
Well, I know just a little bit about body mapping, but I can tell you something. It's much, much more interesting than
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
because it's, for Delsarte, it's a tool of the mind and it's a tool of the will. Let me explain. For example, let's say that you have, two parts of the torso that are acting always together. So you will look at somebody, and when that person is, for example, relaxing, they're trying to have a rest, you will see, for example, that one part of the base of the torso and the first part above, one part is, for example, the sacrum, the second part is the ribs, are going in the same direction all the time. When the person starts to try and get straighter and get active, you will notice that both parts are still going in the same directions. And they are both going backwards that time. So you have got the back, with the ribs are in fact pushing the back, but you've got also the sacrum back, and the person is hunched in the other direction. There is a shortening of the spine in both cases.
Mm-hmm.
So Delsarte would point that to the student. So the student will notice that effectively that's something that is a physical manifestation of the use of these two parts.
Mm-hmm.
And he will draw a little diagram and show that it could be possible to imagine that both parts are opposite to one another, what we call antagonistic action between two levers.
Mm-hmm.
What would that bring? Well, first of all, that would bring a big problem, because first of all, you would notice that your body is not doing what you want, that you want to organize both parts in different directions, but when you look in the mirror, well, you're not doing what you think you're doing. That's why the mirror is here.
Right.
The mirror is there to show you that you have to think differently to, in fact, fool your own sensory appreciation in order for both parts to be really antagonistic in directions. And so, after a while, you will discover something completely incredible, is that you have the power to create movement that are, in fact, different from what you can feel and direct. You have a basic freedom. So Del Sartre called that freedom from yourself. Freedom of the self from oneself. That exact sentence of Del Sartre. And suddenly you discover that you have never exercised any control over your practical will. But that is possible. You just need a model, and just by your mind action, thinking of the two parts that have been shown to you on a picture and seeing you in the mirror, you can suddenly bypass the faulty sensory appreciation problem, is that you're going to act on the levers and you are going to create the antagonistic action, muscular action of the torso. And I think that's exactly how Alexander solved his voice problem in the first place. Mm-hmm. So you have to inhibit your temptation of feeling the movement. But Del Sartre there has it covered for you. He says you should project direction to your reflection. Which a sentence that is so simple that suddenly I said, well, how could I? Because I've tried to understand why would Alexander use the idea of projecting directions. You know, even if in the use of the self, he used projecting direction to the body. Mm-hmm. And to me, that, well, I've been a student of biomechanics for many, many years. I've read Bernstein time and time again. And this idea of projecting direction to muscle is absolutely unscientific. And I couldn't understand that Alexander would go that way. But if you know Del Sartre, the Del Sartre manuscript, suddenly projecting direction to your reflection means that, in fact, instead of trying to feel your way into your body to achieve a movement, you forget about yourself, you get a distance from yourself, you look at the mirror, and you decide that the two parts are going to... Have you ever had this experience of looking at your hand in a mirror? For very often, when you do that, the direction are reversed. That if you want to go left, you have to order yourself to direct right. Otherwise, in the mirror, the hand is going the other way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's exactly this idea.
Well, and it's also the idea that a student, an Alexander student, for example, can gain a lot by observing himself or herself in a mirror, and even in my experience, even more by observing a real-time video of themselves from a camera placed on one side and yeah, looking at a monitor placed in front of them.
Exactly.
That, yeah, in fact, sometimes my own experience is particularly when I'm working with teenagers and young people, just doing that with hardly any verbal guidance can make quite a change.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's
so that's the idea. That's all Del Sartre then, huh?
Yes. But that's still basic.
Yeah.
Because I will point to something that Del Sartre added that is very, very important. Mm-hmm. Is that when you observe, you know, we of course, in the Alexander technique, we were taught to observe that Alexander observed himself in the right mirror all the time. When he forgets to observe in the mirror, he tells he's a fool because he has every opportunities to discover that what he felt was wrong and everything. Yeah, that is clear. But what I discovered in the Del Sartre system, his coding system, is adding something fundamental, is that before looking at yourself in the mirror, you have a drawing, a map. You have a plan. You have a conception in the sense of a description of the relationship between the parts, relationship between the head and the torso, relationship between the different parts of the torso and the limbs. Mm-hmm. That's the Del Sarte was speaking of the perfect chord. He was a musician. So a perfect chord, what is it for Del Sarte? It's the relationship between the parts and the torso and the head. Mm-hmm. He wanted his student to, in fact, completely change their way of directing their reflection between the parts of the torso and the head. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to widen, to lengthen the back, and to organize the head in such a way that the larynx should not be depressed. So when you look at a very, very complex mechanism with your own eyes or your own reason, well, most of the time it's bewildering. It's very, very complex. But if you've got a leading idea, if you've got a presentation of what you should look for, then suddenly the experience can be 10 times more powerful.
Mm-hmm. That would enable you to give less attention to certain details and look more at the big picture then, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And talking about detail, the one detail that has to be forgotten is how does it feel? Mm-hmm. You understand that? Because for Del Sarte, the feeling that is in fact the result of the antagonistic action is of no interest whatsoever. He's very clear about the difference that people forget about the word, the different signification of experience. There are people nowadays that think that experience is what you feel. If you feel the correct adjustment between the parts, there you've got it, you can direct them. For Del Sarte, this is absolutely reversed. It's absolutely false. Experience is, in fact, doing something. It's a trial. You've got experience when you know how to react in a certain situation, not how you should feel in a certain situation.
Right. And wouldn't you agree that that's pretty standard Alexander dogma as well?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Which
I take it that your argument would be that he got that from Del Sarte.
Yes. Yes. Well, he got it from Del Sarte, but unfortunately at one point he started to mix everything up. And I think that nowadays in the modern Alexander Technique world, this confusion exists. I'm hearing here and there the people talking about embodied cognition, for example, or about consciousness, when consciousness in fact means being aware of what you feel, or checking all the time what you are feeling. That is absolutely unlike Del Sarte,
right,
and unlike the early Alexander Technique. It's got to do with the fact that, to make myself very clear, I know many people dislike me for that, but this idea of hands-on as a short way to get the understanding of the Alexander Technique. Well, it is true if it's the modern Alexander Technique. But if we go back to the initial Alexander Technique, which was conscious guidance, mm-hmm. being able to guide yourself with a mental, intellectual plan, well, this is miles and miles away.
Right. The podcast is becoming a bit long. And I do think there's a whole nother thing that we could talk about related to what you we have been talking about, which is really what about Alexander directions and how they changed over the years, and what about the role of hands-on versus self-directing, or how they relate to each other. But I do think they should go in another interview, which we could do later.
Yeah.
But I think this might be a good place to bring this part of the Alexander Del Sarte connection to a close. Yes. Okay with that?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yep. So let me just quickly say that my guest for this podcast has been Jean Doe Massero, an Alexander Technique teacher in Montpellier, France. And this is the second in what may become a three-part series on the connections between Del Sarte and the Del Sarte method, and Alexander and the Alexander technique. Thank you so much for this, John Doe.
Yeah, you're welcome.